Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, researchers are developing blood tests to predict Alzheimer's years ahead of the symptoms. Is this information you'd want? Over the last several years, different teams of researchers have reported progress on experimental blood tests that could identify people in their 70s who are predisposed to developing Alzheimer's disease. Some of the blood tests focus on blood lipids as biomarkers of the disease. At the Institute on Aging, scientists are investigating a protein called IRS1 that could predict serious cognitive decline or Alzheimer's years before the symptoms appear. We're going to learn this hour about how scientists are zeroing in on these biomarkers, but we are also going to talk about the personal and ethical questions that the blood tests and the information raises. When a disease as devastating as Alzheimer's has no cure and still carries a lot of stigma, how much information do we want years ahead? As our guests join us, I'd like you to think about that, and I can see that you are. I tweeted out a question this morning, getting some really good answers on Twitter. If a blood test could tell you with a reasonable amount of certainty that you were headed for Alzheimer's, is that a test that you would take 5 years or even 10 years out? Would it enable you to plan and prepare, or would it paralyze your life? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at Carrie NPR, I want you to think about having access to blood tests that could tell you whether you were headed for Alzheimer's or dementia years ahead of actually being symptomatic, and how you would think about having access to that information, whether this is a test that you'd want. In the Upper Midwest, 800-242-2828. In the Metro, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Emily says, absolutely, staying in the dark a la Matrix, ignorance is bliss, is not something that's ever smart for your health. If you know early on, you can begin to do things to reduce the risk or delay the onset. We'll also talk to our guests about that. Peter Rabens is with us. He's a physician and founding director of Johns Hopkins Geriatric Psychiatry Program, and his new book is titled, Is It Alzheimer's? And he's with us today from Miami, Florida. And Peter, welcome. It's good to have you on the show, and I hope first names are all right with you.
Absolutely, Carrie. Good to meet you on the phone.
Yeah, really good to have you. Shayna Stites is with us. She's a clinical psychologist and researcher with the Penn Project on Precision Medicine for the Brain. And she's with us from the campus at University of Pennsylvania in Philly. And Shayna, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Shayna, I'm going to come right at the what I think is at the heart of this discussion, which is this dilemma around the fear and stigma that surrounds Alzheimer's. I mean, that is why there will be people this morning who tell us they would hesitate to have this information. I know this is something you think about a lot. Give us some context for it as we start the discussion.
Yeah, I think you're right that the fear of the disease is really, and the stigma that surrounds it because of what this disease can do to a person, really is at the heart of the matter. Another closely related part is that there's no treatment currently available to slow or delay the disease's progression. And so it really brings to mind, if you know this information about yourself, that you're very likely to develop symptoms of the disease, what does that mean for you, particularly in light of there not being a treatment? And it raises questions around, well, then why are we doing this? Why do we need to know this information?
Right. Peter, I use the words, it can paralyze your life. Is that hyperbole? Does that happen to some people who get this information?
Well, it may happen to some people, but we have some experience that I think can illuminate the question. We already have genetic markers that can tell people whether they're at increased risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. And there have been several studies now that have shown that at least people who enroll in those studies and are found to have this increased genetic risk don't have adverse outcomes as a group. So it's not exactly parallel to these tests, but I don't think we should assume that it's necessarily bad to provide this information to people.
When you say that these people with the genetic markers are being tested, is that you've inherited the, what, constellation of genes or the gene for early onset Alzheimer's?
Well, there are about 1 or 2% of people have genes that predispose and actually cause early onset Alzheimer's. And in those individuals, if they get the genetic test, they can be almost 100% sure that they'll develop the disease. But there are other genes that are really risk genes. Hmm. And what they do is they might double or triple the likelihood that you'll get the disease compared to someone who doesn't have that gene. And that's the information that we have at present.
All right. Let me take some calls here to Craig in Long Lake. Hi, Craig. How are you thinking about this?
Good morning. Boy, if that thing was available, I would take it immediately. I can't see a reason why people would not want to know in advance so they could plan for the rest of their life.
How would you use the information, Craig, do you think, specifically?
Well, it's a personal thing. A number of us have Alzheimer's in our family, and I've had a very active lifestyle. I eat well, I exercise, I stay active, but if I knew this was on the horizon, I would actually crank up my opportunity to experience this passed life and take full advantage of it.
Shana, I guess that's one perspective, isn't it? I have a limited amount of time with the kind of cognitive quality that I have now, and I'm going to make the most of it. Does that sound compelling to you?
It does, and it sounds familiar to me. The other thing Craig's getting at there is it sounds wonderful. He's living a healthy lifestyle. He's doing the best he can. He has a sense that there's maybe some amount of risk in his family, and so he's working hard to minimize that risk through diet and exercise. But there's that other question that's being answered by learning a gene or a biomarker result, and it's sort of solidifying that, oh, now I know that I'm far more at risk, or I have a quantification of a probability of how much risk there is for me developing this disease. And so maybe I'll make more aggressive decisions about other parts of my life, like when I'm going to retire or going on that vacation, or how much money I'm going to be putting away into my savings, which is, again, those are decisions above and beyond what I'm hoping everybody's doing in terms of diet and exercise.
Peter, Mary Lee says on Twitter, no, I'm nearly certain it's in my future, and I've had conversations with my husband about it already. And then in parentheses, she says, I'm 40. I wonder if age makes a difference in the way people think about getting this information.
I think that's an important question. I don't know the answer to it. It is clear that the older you are, the greater the risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. So that's an important element. I think it's also important to say that many people who develop Alzheimer's disease don't have a family history. So that while people who haven't know it's in their family are at increased risk, having a test available might give information to people who don't already think that they're at increased risk.
Peter, just a question about what has been developed in the research that is now allowing the development of these blood tests. And by the way, I know that they're not yet available to people, patients at large, but what happened to push this research along to make this possible?
Well, I think one reason that people have been pursuing this is that it's clear now that the changes in the brain that lead to Alzheimer's disease are beginning 15 to 20 years before these first symptoms become manifest.
Wow.
So that means that if we're going to have a real prevention, we're going to have to be starting at 10, 15, 20 years before symptoms are likely to develop. And that's really focused the field then on early recognition. And the hope is that by identifying factors in the blood, something that's readily accessible and not too expensive, that we'll be able to have that information to then demonstrate whether we have effective preventions. So that's sort of driven it. I think what's complicated the issue is that if you look, there's a chemical called beta amyloid that appears to be the abnormal protein, one of them involved in Alzheimer's disease. And many people over the age of 70 have that protein in their brain, even though they don't have the symptoms. So the question is, will those people eventually get the disease or not? And that's also sort of driven the search for blood tests or so-called biomarkers that can tell us you are at increased risk and other people are not.
I read this in your book. You write, everyone over the age of 85 has tau deposits in their brain, and many people who have tested as cognitively normal within a year or two of death have pathological abnormalities. So you might see these deposits in the brain, but see that they didn't affect the way the person's brain worked or their cognitive capabilities. Is that right?
That's right. That's one of the great mysteries. Now, of course, we don't know whether eventually all those people will have developed the disease or not. But we do know, as I mentioned, that a significant number of people have these changes in their brain for 10 or 15 years and still don't have symptoms. So we don't know in the long run what will happen to those people.
Shana, this has got to be very interesting to people that do the kind of work you and Peter do to find out why some people are susceptible and others are not.
Yeah. Just to add on to the point, your question before, in terms of why are we learning all of these things now, these discoveries, there's more and more every day that we sort of wake up in the morning, we read more and more about these issues, and we're learning more. You know, as the number of cases of dementia continues to go up, right, largely because we're living to older years, we have more people in older age, and this is a disease that impacts individuals of older age. The more interest that becomes, right, the larger the impacts on our society. The number of people who, if they begin to experience dementia, may have to retire early or aren't going to be, right? And so we've also seen an increase in public funding to study Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
I see.
And that's been really important as the workforce is growing and the financial resources are becoming available that are helping to make some of these discoveries that we're talking about today.
Okay, interesting. If you're just getting in on the show here, we're having a conversation about the science and then the ethical questions that the science is raising around testing for Alzheimer's. We're talking about these different blood tests that are eventually going to be available to average Americans and their physicians, and what you would do with the information. If a blood test could determine whether you were likely, you were susceptible to develop Alzheimer's 10 or 15 years out, is that the kind of information, given the acknowledgement that at the moment there is no cure, and yes, there is some treatment, but it's not going to resolve the Alzheimer's disease, how would you feel about having that information? Would it enable you to plan and prepare? Would it paralyze your life in some ways? Does your age make a difference in the way that you think about this? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to Eric in Golden Valley. Hey, Eric, thanks so much for calling. Good to have you on the line.
Yeah, thanks for this program. A little bit about myself. I took a 23andMe test about a year and a half ago. Found out that I have a rare blood disorder, hereditary hemochromatosis, which is an iron deposition disease, and been treated for it. It was aggressive treatment for about a year, weekly treatments, and everything under control. But I did, you know, I did think about that before I did that test. What would I do with that information? Because I found out I had, you know, some type of a disease like Alzheimer's. And now being on the other side of this, I feel like it's knowledge is power. Had I not done this, the doctors tell me I likely probably wouldn't be here today. My elevations were quite high. And my grandfather passed away about the same age that I am, in my mid-50s, and likely from the same disease. And his wife, my grandmother, passed away from Alzheimer's. So I kind of connect the dots and think, you know, what would I do with that information? if there were treatments out there, I definitely would be more aggressive, and I think I would maybe live my life a little differently knowing that now, being on the other side of this.
Yeah, you've had some experience with facing this. Shayna, I wonder if we are set up as a society to help people deal well with this kind of information. Is that side of the equation progressing as quickly as the medical side of this?
I'd like to give you the optimistic answer. I think it is, yes. Much of my work and that of my colleagues in the Penn Program for Precision Medicine for the Brain ask those questions, right? What happens when people learn risk information about this disease, about themselves, when they're cognitively unimpaired? What do they do with it? How does it impact their lives? And where that's going, to give a little more context here, is, as Peter had suggested, these gene and biomarker tests are being developed. So we can learn if somebody has signs, biological changes associated with the pathology before we see clinical symptoms. Hmm. And that opens a door for people at some point, hopefully in the near future, to be able to get a treatment, to take a therapy that then slows the progression of the pathology. And so that means that we have people living with no symptoms of the disease or milder symptoms of the disease for much longer. And so, again, some of the work that I'm doing is focusing on how do people do that to the best, in the best possible way. How do they continue to stay engaged in the workforce if they want to continue to work and not be discriminated against and forced out? So yes, and much of the research, for example, like we're conducting at University of Pennsylvania, is that social psychological research is embedded right alongside the clinical trials and the biomedical research.
Interesting, huh? Wasn't Peter? What can you add to that?
Well, you know, these ethical questions are tricky ones. We have some information with from another disease, much rarer than Alzheimer's, Huntington's disease. The gene was first identified in the early 1990s, and at that time, the test was about 93% accurate. Huntington's disease is what's called a dominantly inherited disease, which means if you inherit the gene, you will 100% get the disease. And at the beginning, a very high percentage of people who knew this was in their family wanted the gene test. But as the gene test became more accurate, and it's now 100% accurate, the percentage of people who wanted the test actually has gone down significantly.
Wow.
So somewhere between now, 40 and 60% of people who know that it's in their family want the test. So I think it's clear that many people don't want the information or wouldn't want it, and many people do. Huntington's disease is like Alzheimer's disease in that we don't yet have a treatment. I think everyone would agree that if there is a treatment, as there is for a hereditary hemochromatosis, then absolutely we should be trying to detect it early. This is a little more tricky because we don't yet have a treatment. So the question is, would it change people's behavior in a positive way, or would it have negative effects on some people's mood and how they're thinking about their lives?
You know, I do find it interesting, Peter, that the more accurate that Huntington's disease test got, the fewer people wanted it. I mean,
yes, I think that was a surprising result. I don't think people predicted that. Again, it may also be that at the beginning, that the people that were it was such a new finding that everybody wanted to find out the information, and that over time people became more thoughtful about it individually. So I don't think we understand everything that goes into these decisions, but I do think we should realize that people have many different feelings, and there'll always be people who want all information. There'll be other people who say, you know, I'm going to live my life to the fullest no matter what, so I don't need that information.
Right. Becky says, or Bonnie says, I don't think so. I don't have family issues related to this. I wouldn't want the test. Here's Becky who says, definitely there are measures you can take that you should take anyways to avoid the disease for as long as possible, mostly by living a healthy lifestyle. Also, so you can plan for your care later. To the phones, to Kathleen in St. Paul. Kathleen, it sounds like you have confronted some of the ethical questions that we're talking about here.
Well, Carrie, I want to say, first of all, thank you, because you recently used the word empowered. And I think that is so critically important for people who are fearful of the diagnosis. For someone who, like me, who was 5 years ago diagnosed with what was early stage Alzheimer's, and was told by the neurologist it looked like I would have full-blown Alzheimer's within 5 years, it was important to send me away with kind of a roadmap for things that I could do, focusing on the things I could do, not the things that I wasn't able to do anymore, like remember where you left things and all of these typical symptoms. I am going to have my 5th anniversary of that diagnosis this April. I am living alone. I'm in a senior campus, but I am independent. And I took all of the advice and suggestions, maybe they were mandates, from my neurologist, who said, you have to exercise, cardio, 45 minutes, 3 days a week. You have to do brain exercise, either learn a language or take up a musical instrument. And he went on and on and on with things that I felt I could do, and I have done. And I have to say, I am eternally grateful for having had the opportunity to start to deal with the disease, so that now at the age of 75, I can enjoy a rich, full life, admittedly with a lot of adjustments and limitations. But I know that it's all because I got that start. And the psychoneurologist who evaluated me last year said, oh my goodness, woman, it looks like you've hit a plateau. And I think, Carrie, if you've had an Alzheimer's diagnosis, it's pretty good news to hear you've hit a plateau. So that's my story.
Kathleen, I just have a question. I'm really glad you called and you heard the show this morning. Are you careful about who you tell, who you share this information with, because of what we started out talking about, which is how people react?
Actually, not, because I turned it around and I saw it as a resource. Over the last 5 years, there have been many, many people who've been sent to have coffee with me. They're suspicious about their mom, or they're suspicious about their own behaviors. And what an opportunity for me to say, look, this is not the death sentence you think it is. There is something you can do. And so I've had no problems, no reticence. I think most people are just glad to know that there is still life after a diagnosis.
Kathleen, thanks so much for making the call and for listening in today. Shana, what do you hear in Kathleen's experience?
Oh, that was two things that are really important. One of which is, I want to clarify what I was saying before, as I was talking about we're doing this testing in order to be able to identify the disease earlier before symptoms.
Yeah.
The treatments that we're looking for clearly include drug and pharmaceutical therapies, but they also include a wide range of other things, exercise, diet interventions, and some of the other interventions that she listed. And then the second part, that closing note of there's life after a diagnosis, is so spot on and poignant. I hear that a lot. There's a public stigma around this disease. And when someone is diagnosed with it, that's the reaction that the world hands them. You're done now, right? It's the disease of two deaths. And that's not the case. There are people that have a diagnosis that are living well, happy, productive, engaged lives. And so the ability to turn that stigma around or confront it is really powerful.
Peter, are we on the road to that, do you think? More information, more people talking about it openly like Kathleen is? Or are we in kind of this transition point, a lot of fear around it still?
Well, unfortunately, there is still a lot of fear. But I think with the bravery of people like Kathleen, I think that is turning around. In fact, one of the first people to come out publicly on the subject was Nancy Reagan, when she talked about her husband's diagnosis back in the 1980s. That had a tremendously positive impact at the time. And I think gradually that the stigma has been melting away some, but I think the fear is still there. One of the areas of research that I've been engaged in my career is looking at quality of life in people with Alzheimer's disease. And what we found is that overall, people with Alzheimer's disease can have a positive quality of life and do have a positive quality of life throughout the disease. And I think that's an important message. Again, it's not a death sentence. It doesn't mean people should be put away and hidden. People should continue to live just as Kathleen has been, and they will enjoy life and be wonderful grandparents and get all the pleasures that other people can experience.
Yeah. I want to let you know, if you've just gotten in on the show, Peter Rabins is our guest. He's a physician, and he's founding director of Johns Hopkins Geriatric Psychiatry Program, and he has a new book titled Is It Alzheimer's? Very Practical, Straightforward Information. Shana Stites is with us. She's a clinical psychologist and a researcher at the Penn Project on Precision Medicine for the Brain at the University of Pennsylvania. Back to the phone lines here to Angela in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Angela, really grateful that you waited. Thanks much for that.
That's all right. I'm just calling to say that it would be really hard to get the test, but I think I would definitely want to get the test just so I could make plans for my care and whatnot. I'm currently taking care of my mom, who has Alzheimer's, and there are certain decisions that, as her power of attorney or in healthcare power of attorney, that I have to make that I wish she could have made herself, you know, when to do her DNR and certain things like that. So, and it takes a lot from people's lives to be caretakers.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But I really feel like in some ways my mom wouldn't have wanted that, you know? So I think if I had the diagnosis or the potential, I would want to make sure that I could set up my future in a way that I would be well cared for, but those that I love would still be able to lead their lives.
Yeah, I mean, Angela, you're talking about you would be empowered to make some of these decisions and choices for yourself, which would then free your family of some of that.
Yeah,
right.
Who would care for me when I would move, at what stage of the disease this choice would be made. You know, it has a fairly predictable trajectory. Maybe the timeline is a little bit different, but the deterioration is predictable.
Glad you were listening this morning. Peter, you have a big section in the book on caregiving. Do you want to say something about how that fits into this today?
Yes, I think first I'd want to say that Angela's absolutely right, that thinking about these decisions ahead of time is very important. Ideally, everyone would do that now, since the lifetime risk now of getting Alzheimer's disease is very high. If you live to 80, the average person has at least a 20% chance of getting the disease. So since that's about the average life expectancy in the U.S., I think everyone should be having those discussions that she mentioned with loved ones earlier in life. The truth is that doesn't happen often. So one of the positives of a test like this would be that it might push people to have these discussions, to think about these really difficult issues ahead of time. And again, in that sense, overcome the stigma. I think stigma partly prevents people from having these discussions. So that would be one of the positives of having a accurate predictive test.
Dawn says on Twitter, I'm going to the doc today to see if my memory loss and poor executive function is early onset Alzheimer's. I'm 46. My work depends solely on my knowledge and expertise. So what I would like to know ASAP. I wish you well with that, Dawn. Brenda raises a question that I want to get to on the other side of news. She says, I have a family member who knows and immediately started living self-fulfilled prophecy-type actions. How do we confront this? Her anxiety is off the charts about it. Okay, so on the other side of news, I think we touched on this. We heard Shana and Peter a bit on this, but I want to come back to this idea of how, as with Kathleen's experience, this is not the end. There are ways to live onto and into Alzheimer's. That does not mean that your life is over. I want to talk to Peter and Shana about that and have your experience with this as well. Also talking today about whether with these tests, these blood tests availability, how you'd think about what to do with this information. Does your age make a difference in the way you think about it? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, of course on Twitter, @Kerri, KERRI, NPR. Back to our conversation, Peter Rabens with us from Johns Hopkins Geriatric Psychiatry Program. Shana Stites with us from the University of Pennsylvania and the Penn Project on Precision Medicine for the Brain. A quick question that I want to ask you, Peter. Kathy tweets, I assume this test is only to identify Alzheimer's, not other dementias. Are these blood tests only about Alzheimer's or other dementia?
Well, you should ask that to Shane as well. Well, some are specific for Alzheimer's. There are other tests that are looking at biomarkers that might assess brain degeneration more generally. So really, both are in development in different places.
And Shana, I have a question for you about, I was reading about this connection between brain changes in people with diabetes that appears to put them at risk for dementia. Is there some kind of a connection there?
A connection between diabetes and dementia?
Yeah, what happens to the brain with in people that have diabetes and whether that makes you susceptible to dementia.
I see. So let me back up for a second to clarify. So dementia refers to a set of symptoms of cognitive and functional impairments. It can be traced to a number of different types of underlying pathologies.
Okay.
So different types of pathology can all sort of go down this road of progression that causes this set of symptoms we refer to as dementia. Does that help?
That is helpful. Yeah.
Excellent. And the most common type or cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
Majority of the time that we see somebody who has dementia, it's being caused by a pathology that we call Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
And there is some overlap in mechanisms. I don't know. We want to go too far down that path. It gets nuanced quickly, but there is some connection in mechanisms. But there's also this connection in just the clinical presentation. So you could see, for instance, in some cases of diabetes, that you might have atrophy, and atrophy would also be, which is that thing that's associated with a cognitive decline. And you would also be seeing that in Alzheimer's disease. It's that atrophy, the pathology leads to a brain atrophy that you can see on imaging, and that also is connected as the brain deteriorates, then we see these symptoms emerge.
Okay. Call here from Dan in St. Paul. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for waiting through the newscast there.
No problem. I have worked a little bit in the genetics area, and the issue that I just like to bring up is, you know, where the science is at this point. You know, the BRCA gene is one of the, you know, case studies where the women were getting prophylactic mastectomies.
Right.
And later it was determined that, you know, the research wasn't as advanced as people thought. And I think, you know, we're kind of getting into the same area that if you are given this either a clean bill of health or that, you know, you're predisposed, you're still, you know, left with a lot of questions.
Shana, do you see a comparison in the one that Dan's making there with the BRCA gene?
You know, I think I do. I see where he's going. And you could say that the BRCA gene, there's also some other medical sort of avenues we've taken where we think we understand a disease and we jump very quickly and aggressively into intervention and prevention. What's unique about what we're talking about here in Alzheimer's disease is we're not jumping quickly into intervention or prevention because we don't have anything yet. We're still in the process of developing it. So it's a little different than I think in that way from what we were seeing in BRCA.
And Peter, I read this tweet from Brenda before we went to the newscast saying that she's got a family member who's going through this. How do we confront this? Her anxiety is off the charts about it. I think you addressed some of this in the book. What would you say?
Well, first, it's important to remember that every test and every treatment has downsides as well as upsides. And one of the reasons that the research that people like Shane is doing is so important is we need to know how often are people paralyzed by anxiety or worry if they have a positive. And we don't have those answers yet, but I think at least the previous genetic studies suggest that's not that common an outcome. Again, I think it's important that if people are overwhelmed by anxiety, even if it's a small percentage, that they get help, that they can talk with genetic counselors who can put the results in context, that they can think through the positives and negatives. And for many people, it's really an overreaction, and that there are things that can be done to help them have a much more positive and attitude and focus on doing what they can to control things for the near future.
Call here from Todd, listening in Duluth. Hey, Todd. Hi.
Hey. Yeah, good morning. So I have a more of a financial impact question. Once we get the blood test and it's in our medical file, and if it is positive, there's going to be certainly an impact on the ability for that person to get long-term care insurance and or life insurance, which could be a $500,000 or more financial impact down the road. So I'm just curious on comments about that that dilemma in increased and more knowledge that we do receive.
Julie added this on Twitter. Insurability is a huge factor in these decisions. Peter, how can you enlighten us on this? What does this mean?
I think those are very important points. Legislation has already been passed to protect genetic information. But I think in the long run, we don't know how really secure first that information is. And second, if those tests are available, can they be required by insurers, for example? I think there are a lot of ethical questions that come up. And again, that's why this research is so important, that before we leap to providing these tests and having them readily available, we need to be thinking through these issues and protecting people's information as much as we can so that there aren't adverse effects on the one hand. On the other hand, I think we have to appreciate the insurers' point of view that if people are going to be able to get this information and then that drives them to get insurance ahead of time, is that really appropriate? So how we balance these issues, I think, is a very difficult question that as a society we need to be thinking through now.
I should ask you both how far out these tests are to being widely available. Shana, how many years would you say?
That's a good question. So there's a national plan to develop a disease-modifying treatment for Alzheimer's disease by 2022. I don't know, which I think there's a lot of people working to make that goal, and we'll have to see how that lands. And so a lot of this testing, I'm not sure we specifically talked about today, but some of the gene and biomarker testing that's out there is being used in clinical trials or prevention trials to test these therapies that we're trying to develop in time to meet our national goal. And as soon as there are viable therapies, it seems clear that these advances would start to be translated into routine practice. They're not at this point, and I think for many of the reasons we were just talking about or Peter was pointing out, we're not quite ready for it. But it's largely because there isn't that disease-modifying therapy.
Yeah,
which is good. It gives us the time to work through some of these questions around data safety.
Penelope says on Twitter, both parents had dementia. I'm 60 and I'm doing all I can to change my feared trajectory. Going to aqua aerobics 4 times a week, learning to play the banjo, eating whole foods, lots of plants. All of these enrich my life regardless. I think I would want to know. You know, Shana, the thing that, I mean, and we've alluded to this in the conversation, there are things to do now to be focused on this. And if the prospect of these blood tests raises awareness on that, all good, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And it gets the conversation going. I'm so happy that we're talking today and talking through some of these issues. You know, I've seen cases, there's people seem very sad as we're listening to the callers. Either they're saying they want to go get the test or they don't want the test and they feel clear on it. There's a lot that goes into that decision. And I have seen people change their mind in both directions.
Huh.
You say you don't want it and you come to a place where you decide, you know what, it really would be helpful. Or you learn it and wish you didn't know it. And so having these conversations, giving space to be able to think through what we really want to do, and then, of course, having the right to choose based on, you know, what we, a decision we come to, what we want to know or don't want to know about ourselves.
All right. Call here from Emily in Oakdale. Hi, Emily. Sounds like you want to speak to what Shana just said.
Yeah, I'm someone, I'm 33, and I was diagnosed with a so-called incurable chronic illness, autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. And I found that the way the doctor spoke to me was really a huge disservice to my overall health. I think we often give medical professionals all authority over our health, and we resign our personal responsibility and just accept the sentence of what they say. Mm-hmm. And after several years of suffering, I got to a point where I just said, I need to do everything in my power to get healthy and change my life. And I have been able to get rid of all of my symptoms. I consider myself cured. And I think the biology of our beliefs does reflect in how our genes express disease. And if we are telling people that they have diseases or the potential for disease, I think that will promote it actualizing.
Yeah, I think you raise a good question about how the medical community, the way they approach this, fits into this. Peter, what do we know about how prepared, I don't know, your family doctor or the doctors that you're going to be, that your neurologist, are for empowering conversations about what happens next?
Well, I like to be an optimist and be positive, but I do think that many doctors are confused about these issues, just as the public is. Genetics has become very complicated since we've been able to sequence the human genome 20 years ago. And I think many doctors don't know how to counsel people about genetic risk. And I would worry that if we have tests like this that identify people at high risk for other diseases like Alzheimer's disease, that general physicians won't have the skill set or the training that they need and in order to advise people. And then does that mean that everyone has to go to a specialist who has the training? I think, again, discussing these issues now is so important because we have to prepare. This is the future of medicine, is being able to identify people at risk for all sorts of conditions, and how we do that, how we train the medical workforce, how we train people in the population to deal with it. It's a whole new world.
Yeah, I mean, Shana, my most trusted interaction with someone in the medical field is my, you know, OBGYN, the person that I see. I want to know that she knows how to handle a conversation about this if I would choose to take the test. So where does that begin? In medical schools? What do you do with the people that are already out in the field?
Oh, so some of it, that's interesting you raised that as a, you'd want to be talking to your OBGYN about getting tested for Alzheimer's disease or another type of
disease. Yeah, I trust her. Yeah.
Because you trust her. Yeah. And that is, you know, new models. This diverges a little in the conversation. Just bear with me for a second. There are new models of care that are always being discussed. Yeah, how do we deliver the best type of medicine that we can? And part of what we're up against here is that you have two specialties that are sort of banging head with a patient who just wants to talk to the provider they have that's most trusted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so would it be possible that this is actually more of a question for how we deliver care? Can your OBGYN pick up a call, pick up a phone and call a neurologist with expertise in this to figure out how to have that conversation with you in a way that's giving you the best, most reliable information?
Right.
And how do we navigate that?
Right.
And that's a whole other set of questions that we need to figure out, especially as medicine continues to become more and more complex, and those specialties are so needed in order to manage the scientific complexity that's emerging.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear Peter say this is the future of medicine, I think I don't want to be in the office of some specialist I met the very first time I had a test. You know, I don't have a relationship with that person. These are big life decisions and conversations. I'd want to have it with the person that I trust most. But I think I hear you saying the moment, the way we get care isn't really set up for that.
Right, because the emphasis is on getting you the best quality information. And while you can trust that person to be candid with you or open with you and honest about what it is they know, they may actually not have the facts to be able to share with you.
Right.
And so on one side, you have facts and accuracy, and on the other side is this very important intimacy and trust and relationship. And so how do we find the right way to marry those things?
Peter, while we're talking about the future, I was reading something that a researcher at the University of California has said about drug development and the future. My vision of the future is you have your breakfast cereal, and on one side you have a statin for cardiovascular disease. I guess we all need statins. And on the other side, you have three pills to prevent dementia. Well, is that the future? How far would you say?
I don't think it's going to be within 4 or 5 years myself, but I hope I'm wrong. I do think prevention with a disease like Alzheimer's disease and the other neurodegenerative illnesses is going to be the key. And figuring that out, again, is very challenging. But I do think that's the future. You know, when you eat cereal in the morning, that's fortified with vitamins. Like vitamin B1, for example, and vitamin B12. Those vitamins are specifically in cereal and other things that are made with flour to prevent diseases of memory. There's an illness called Korsakoff syndrome that's rare, but can be prevented by giving people thiamine or vitamin B1. So we're actually already doing that in a small way. I do think that that probably will be the future.
What would you say, Shana?
I would agree in terms of prevention being one of the most important things that we can do here. Absolutely. That's, again, going back to our very first caller who said he's got a good diet, getting the right exercise, and doing everything he can to promote brain health would be the best place to be starting.
Carrie, if I could add one other prevention that we haven't touched on that's crucial, I think, and that is getting high blood pressure treated.
Ah.
I think the evidence is really building now that high blood pressure in midlife is a very significant risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And now it's looking like even treating high blood pressure later in life in people's 70s lowers the risk. So in addition to the diet, exercise, all those important things that we've been talking about, controlling high blood pressure and undesirable blood lipids, I think, is also a key to prevention.
Good to know. Hey, thank you both for a really interesting and enlightening conversation. Shana, thank you. Good to have you from
Absolutely.
The University of Pennsylvania. Peter, thank you very much. Good to have you from Johns Hopkins.
Thank you, Carrie.
And Peter's book is called Is It Alzheimer's? I'll tweet out a link to that. And I really appreciate the candor and the calls this morning in the conversation.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.